Pakistan office and one from our Johannesburg office. They do cover largely the same things, but there were some additional ones from the Cape Town office, which is why I did submit the additional one. And the references I will make now will be to that Cape Town submission. If a distribution is made of the share premium, portion of which is deemed to be a dividend, then what will have happened within the company that's made that distribution is that that share premium will have been paid out for accounting purposes, leaving reserves. When the next distribution is made, the reserves will be issued and dividend tax or STC paid. What is important to remember is that the share premium will have been paid out, and as a consequence, STC will be paid on an amount which will represent capital return to the shareholders, which will never again then be seen as share premium. And I think it's important that the legislation includes something that reverts a portion of the share reserves into capital, so that ultimately if the company is liquidated, the true amount of share capital is reflected as a return of capital and not as dividend. Otherwise, you're going to have STC paid on true capital in the long term. The other aspect relating to the share premium apportionment, which is important, is the fact that it requires a market value to be made on the distribution of the share premium of the various types of shares. And to do that at each time that that premium is paid out is very inefficient, particularly for private companies. The next section which I'd like to refer you to is Clause 12, which refers to the 9C capital deeming for disposal of shares. We welcome this particular provision, and it does give a lot of certainty to persons who are disposing of shares within the period of 3 years. I'd like to reiterate SAICA's submission that the disposal of shares by a resident in a non-resident company is not covered, and we wonder if this is an oversight or intentional, particularly where those sales are made to another resident. It's also questioned by us whether the exclusion of a reference to preference shares is intentional. Surely if an individual or a company holds shares for more than 3 years, then whether those shares are ordinary shares or preference shares or any other type of shares should be irrelevant. If they're held on capital intent, then that should be the way they are treated. Furthermore, there's no reference made to shares like capitalization shares or subdivided shares. If one looks at the old or the existing 9B, which refers to the five-year rule, those types of shares are referred to. And we feel it's important that reference be made to those to clarify whether if one is issued with, for example, capitalization shares on existing shares that have been held for the required period, they would not also assume that same period of holding. Finally, in that particular section, the reference to immovable property provisions is somewhat unclear. It talks about looking at the value of the company and how much of that company relates to immovable property, but it doesn't make clear whether one must take into account whether if there are liabilities against that immovable property, for example, a bond, does one set that off against the value of the property when looking at the value of the company? The suggestion we make is that perhaps they refer to the 8th schedule, the para 2 of the 8th schedule, which talks about an interest in immovable property, and rather changes the 80% reference there to 50%, because we all seem to understand how that one works. Clause 26 is the next section I would like to look at, which relates to Section 13 Quinn, and my colleagues at Deloitte and SAICA have also spoken very much about the commercial property allowances, and we're very pleased that the Treasury and SARS has decided to include commercial property in the provisions which recognise that there is depreciation of property. But we'd like to support SAICA's submission that where a purchaser acquires a property on which this allowance was previously permitted, that they should be allowed to continue the allowance. Simply because there's been a change of ownership of a property should not change the fact that that the allowances are allowed and the depreciation continues. In addition, it's not clear from the draft legislation whether improvements to property after the effective date would be included, and we again support our colleagues that the improvements should be allowed to be catered for under the deduction. This would again provide for consistency of treatment of buildings. Clause 34, you've just heard the submission by SAB regarding the intellectual property. We have a number of serious concerns with this provision. We can see there is a purpose for it, its introduction by the Treasury and SARS, but do have the following concerns. As mentioned by SAB and PwC, it relates to intellectual property sold at any time in the past by any resident to a non-resident. And as raised previously, the question that came to mind in our heads was, what is the situation where one is paying royalty to a non-resident and isn't aware of the fact that at some point in the past that intellectual property was owned by a resident? That could cause a situation where that resident who's paying the royalty and deducting that royalty is breaking the law without even knowing that that is the case. One needs to have certainty in tax, and in this particular provision there cannot be certainty. If it was sold to a non-resident who's connected, then clearly one can see that there would be that knowledge, but not if it's to an unconnected person. The next question that we have is a little bit of a turnaround from the SAB submission, where SAB indicated that intellectual property can be enhanced by a user. The question that we have here is, if the user is the local person and the intellectual property has been sold to a non-resident in the past, and the local person is enhancing that intellectual property through its use and enhancement, then what proportion of the royalty paid to that non-resident should be disallowed? How do you determine that particular amount? Again, it makes it very difficult to comply with the law when one is faced with these kind of uncertainties and difficulties. The final concern we had relating to this particular section is the provision which talks about the fact that if the person receiving the royalty includes that in income, that would be South African taxable income, and clearly then the amount would be taxed, then the royalty restriction is lifted. The question that we have there is that often one has situations where there are offshore companies which are effectively managed in South Africa and are therefore treated as residents for South African tax purposes and include amounts in the income in their hands. However, the royalty may flow through a sublicensee offshore and only be included after flowing through that sublicensee. It's not clear from the legislation whether, because it's included ultimately, the royalty is ultimately included in the resident's hands and taxed in that resident's hands, that the royalty restriction will be lifted. And I would request SARS and the Treasury to clarify that in that draft legislation. Moving to clause 40 in our submission, this relates to transfer pricing. Transfer pricing generally in South Africa refers to a situation where you've got transfers between connected persons from South Africa to offshore or from offshore to South Africa. However, the wording, we believe, has perhaps been inadvertently implemented or put in the draft legislation to the effect that it now appears to apply to local transfer pricing. I would doubt very much that this is the intention of SARS and the Treasury, because it isn't stated in the explanatory memorandum, and we would request that that wording be corrected. If we move to clause 44, this relates to environmental expenditure, and the environmental expenditure is allowed in respect of certain expenditure which is in terms of a legislation. It relates to waste treatment, recycling, and equipment for those things and for monitoring. However, the question that arises in our minds is, what about the situation where it isn't that the particular waste treatment, recycling, or monitoring equipment is not required by law, but the taxpayer has chosen to be environmentally friendly and to expend these amounts in any event, and we would request that the amount that be allowed to be deducted relates, provided that it relates to the specific items which are catered for in the legislation, that those amounts be allowed to be deducted as well. Moving to clause 60, the seventh schedule relating to expatriate housing. We would like to support PwC in its submission in the fact that 183 days is too short for a non-resident expatriate coming into South Africa. There is a skills shortage and we do need to transfer those skills to South Africans. And we find that most secondments tend to be in the range of around about 2 years. Obviously, SARS and Treasury need to make a decision on the time period, but 183 days is 6 months. And generally that would be a very, very short secondment and not really long enough to cater for the transfer of skills. The other aspect which we'd like to raise in that particular provision, and we see this with employees tax all the time, is that the effective date of the provision is years of assessment, which would effectively end on the 28th of February 2008 for an individual's tax year. Now, obviously, for employees tax purposes, we're already into October, and March to October would have been catered for under the previous legislation. The problem we have is that now employers will have short deducted on their expatriates and will need to make good that shortfall if this effective date isn't moved to a future point. So we would suggest the effective date either be from the date of promulgation of this Act or to the 1st of March 2008. One of the clauses that has been mentioned by PwC, SAICA and Deloitte relates to clause 70 and 71. The taxation of the capital distributions talked about in paragraph 76A of the 8th schedule. This is the paragraph which talks about the distribution of premiums, for example, which are then added to the proceeds or deducted from the base costs, and PwC made a very clear submission as to how this all works. We do understand that SARS and the Treasury want to change the rules in connection with this, but are very concerned about the fact that distributions have been made between 2001 and the present, and receipts have been received by taxpayers of these capital distributions, and that there is the intention that they should be all taxed on the 1st of July 2008. And the concern we have there is that the amounts involved can be significant and the cash flow implications on individuals is huge. So if Treasury and SARS is going to proceed with what we would agree is a form of retrospective legislation, we would suggest that in order to ease the cash flow, this tax would be payable in a phased approach. In other words, not required to be paid in a lump sum in that particular year, but phased in over a period of time. The tax would have been payable in any event at some point when those shares were disposed of, so clearly there's not an objection to the tax being payable. It's the fact that there seems to be the intention that an amount be payable in one lump sum at that particular date. And that's is the end of my submission. Thank you very much.
I have to ask for permission also. thanks. That then brings us to the end of the submission by KPMG. And are there any questions? I see among the big four, only one of them didn't make a submission. They knew very well that you represent them well in the industry. And I think you've just done that. Okay. Are there any questions, members? Ms. Fubbs?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I thought I put it on, but that's the better then, yeah. The point here is just a clause which perhaps wasn't commented on, or I just didn't hear it. The official clause 56, where you've got here the official rate of interest is used to exclude the deeming of low interest loans. So you know that particular one. Perhaps you could just expand on that particular one. But certainly the idea of the timelines that you were referring to in clause 60 would appear to make some sort of sense. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. At the risk of being shouted down, we put this into this submission, and perhaps it should rather go into the suggestions for Annex C for the review next year. But the clause 56, it relates to the section 64C deemed dividend provisions, and in those provisions they say that if you've given an interest-free loan or a loan which is lower than the official rate of interest, which is a rate which is used for fringe benefits, then there will be a deemed dividend and SPC will be payable on their own. And we have a number of clients who submit to us that they are able to obtain interest-bearing loans at much lower than the official rate of interest. And therefore, this is penalizing them in the sense that they are treated, if the loan is from a connected person, essentially they are treated as having an SPC event, where if they were to go to a third party and obtain the same loan, that would not occur. So we are suggesting to SARS and the Treasury that perhaps they should reconsider that particular provision. But I know that Keith Engel won't like the fact that I've raised it because it's not in the current legislation. Thank you. Thank you.
The end of the discussion.